Good afternoon and welcome to Family Business Radio. It is June 2nd. It is 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so that means it's time for Family Business Radio. And through our Family Business Radio show, we are showcasing family businesses and building a community designed to educate, inform, and support family-owned businesses. So each week our guests include family business owners, key executive non-family members who are helping to drive those businesses, and the trusted professional advisors that assist them. I am co-host of Family Business Radio, Pat Romboletti, with Sage Executive Search.
And I am Meredith Moore, here with Moore & Associates Wealth Management. And I'm actually really excited today. We have yet another common theme that seems to keep coming up on our shows. And basically, we always talk about how important it is to surround yourself with a team of outside advisors who can help guide you and your business. Our guests today are great examples of what a difference it really can make to ensure success by surrounding yourself with such said advisors.
So I'd like to introduce our guests first, Craig Kaufman of Kaufman Realty Group. Welcome, Craig.
Thank you.
And Larry Hart, Master Chair of Vistage International. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. You know, Craig, it appears to me that you are not a native of Atlanta. Where did you get your start?
I grew up in New Jersey, and I got my professional start in New York City as well as St. Louis. I went to college and grad school in St. Louis, Washington University, and moved out here about 15, 16 years ago in an attempt to start up a real estate investment company.
Well, I know that a lot of real estate entrepreneurs come up through a sales or brokerage track, but that isn't the case for you.
No, that's correct. I guess you could say I'm more of a numbers geek. I came from the analytical background. I started as an analyst, had an engineering background, and started as a financial analyst for a large real estate development firm in New York City. And analyzed many deals, things that worked, things that didn't work, before starting out of my own.
Oh, great background. And Larry, I know that while you've been leading Vistage for a long time, you had a strong corporate career. Can you share a little bit of your background with our guests?
Well, I go back to the corporate career and way back in the 70s, which, of course, immediately dates me as to what I'm at here today. But spent time in the chemical business in sales and marketing many, many years ago for a company that no longer exists, Union Carbide.
Yeah. So, and kind of some other entrepreneurial ventures that you probably bring that experience into Vistage, I'm assuming.
Well, I have. I'm one of these folks that people would say I couldn't hold a job because this is really about my fourth career, as you might define it, anywhere from sales and marketing to the financial planning business in the early years to owning my own franchise and training and development and then some consulting and now as a chair with Vistage.
Excellent.
And Larry's other title as a member of Larry's group is he's a great herder of cats, because that's what a Vistage chair has to do.
Well, it probably fits in with your franchise business as well.
Absolutely.
Craig, before we get started really in the discussion about your business, I know our audience would love to hear your thoughts on what's going on in the commercial real estate marketplace right now.
Well, if those in the audience are tenants, people who occupy office space, this is a great time to be a tenant. My perspective is it's the best of times and it's the worst of times, depending on who's where you're sitting. There is a glut of office space on the market. Approximately 20% of the Atlanta office market is vacant. In Buckhead, as an example, about 28% of the Buckhead Class A market is vacant. So There's plenty of alternatives and choices, and if you're a business in a position to lock down your space needs for a number of years, you can cut an aggressive deal. If you're an investor looking for opportunities, many people oftentimes think, I get cocktail party conversations, people ask me, gosh, it must be a great time, Craig, to buy real estate. And again, I'm in commercial real estate, not residential, and commercial has lagged several years behind residential. But people think the shoe has dropped, that there's, you know, just terrible distress, and there is. But it's almost as if the shoe has dropped, but it's been suspended in animation, just suspended out there. Sellers are not being forced to sell. Lenders are just not being forced to sell and to mark their collateral to market value. So what's happening right now is there's a scarcity premium. There's a bunch of money out there and very few properties that have sold. And this morning I put together just a few statistics just to give you an idea of how little there is that's selling. In 2007 and 8, each of those years had about $5 billion of office building sales, office buildings over $5 million in value, totaling up to $5 billion in sales each year. 2009, we had only $70 million of sales.
Oh, my goodness.
It's almost as if there's just, you know, the faucet has turned off. And it's starting to trickle again. Year-to-date, 2010, we've got about $70 million. So the first few months this year, we've totaled up to about all we had last year. Mm. But it's and it'll probably increase in pace, but it's just, you know, a little faster trickle.
Interesting. Larry, we listed you as the master chair of Vistage, but Vistage is such an important group for our audience that I would love for you to share some insight on what is Vistage all about and then a little bit more in particular about your groups.
Okay. Vistage is a company. It's not very well known, unfortunately. It's been around for a long time. This is about our 53rd year. We started in 1957. Mm-hmm. And what Vistage is the world's largest CEO membership organization. And what we do is bring CEOs, owners of companies, people with strong P&L responsibility in their organizations together as groups. You'll hear people talk about Vistage groups. Mm-hmm. So Craig, for example, is a member of a group of CEOs and business owners that typically we have 12 to 16 members in a group, no competing industries, different sizes. Craig's group, for example, starts at around $15 million in revenue, and our largest member has about $180 million in revenue. So averages out around 50, mm-hmm. Type of thing. And what we're really there to do is to help build them as leaders and help make them more effective so they can build their businesses. A lot of consultants candidly work with companies. We work with the top individual. Mm-hmm. And various components is we have a monthly meeting. Our Vistage members dedicate an entire day every month to their Vistage group, plus they spend a couple of hours every month with me. And my role can be, depending upon that particular person, could be as much as it could be a mentor, could be a coach. But with some of the members have been with me for a number of years and their business and their capabilities have grown, I tend to be more of my favorite term is thinking partner. Mm-hmm. I'm in there to go behind closed doors and I don't have an agenda. Mm-hmm. And so it's we bring in speakers, and our membership's up to almost 15,000 now, so we connect people from all over the world. It's an incredible organization.
And how many groups do you manage?
I have three groups. I have what would be defined as a larger CEO group. Again, most of our businesses are privately held. Mm-hmm. Probably about half of them are family businesses. And what I would call my larger CE group, chief executive group, they'll average around $50, $60 million. I have a smaller group that starts at about $1 million and goes up to around 10. They're averaging up around $3, $4 million. And then I have what's called a Vistage key group, which are people who work for these CEOs and owners in roles such as any C-level, VP level, director level type of thing. And they're in there for development, leadership development purposes also.
Man, very comprehensive.
Now, Craig, I know you've been a big part of Vistage for 12 years. From what Larry's describing, that's a pretty big investment in time. Can you kind of give your perspective on what impact has that group had on you and your business and how you've developed things?
I think the best way I can describe it is yes.
It
has had a positive impact on me. I've been part of Vistage now for 12 years. The thing about most business owners, I think, as I talk to my peer groups, is we tend to bury ourselves, if we're not careful, in the details of our business. And if we don't have people who can help us pull us up and sort of work on the business as opposed to in the business, and that's a cliche that someone else invented, not me, It can be very myopic, and we can go through life and through our business with blinders. So in more specifically, my business is cyclical. It's hyper-cyclical. It's more cyclical than typical businesses are. And when I think about what Vistage has brought to me, it has brought me stability. In the last 12 years, it's probably, you know, one of the most common things I can tell you is every third Tuesday, I can tell you where I'll be, and I can attend. And there's an incredible amount of candid feedback, and I will tell you sometimes it's brutally candid feedback that you can't pay your friends, family, or even your advisors to get, but peers in the group that just will tell you as they see it. Oftentimes, to the extent you may not want to hear it at the time, but so it kind of, for me, it's kept me focused and, if you will, sort of on point. I've gone through changes in my personal life. I've gone through business plan changes. I've gone through partnership changes. And I have consulted with the group, you know, in each of those different sort of opportunities and challenges.
It's a very holistic, really, I mean, comprehensive to all aspects of your life, not just your business. Craig, right. let's get into more detail of your business. We talked in general about the real estate, but you launched your business in 1994, very different times than we have in 2010. Can you share a little bit about the background of how you got started?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned earlier, I was working not in Atlanta. I was previously in New York and then St. Louis. And although things were different in 1994, there are some similarities in the industry that I'm in, commercial real estate and real estate investment. We had just gone through an incredibly dark real estate recession in the very late 80s, sort of popped in the late 80s, and took several years till the mid-1990s until we started feeling recovery. So there are some similarities, the difference, though, being that the overall economy was not weak and the financial markets were not distraught like they are now. I was living in St. Louis during much of this, and I was doing workouts, fee-based consulting and appraisal. And I can still remember back, this goes back 15, 16, 17 years, to conversations I had with my father, who was working on Wall Street, who was candidly thinking I was wasting my life living anywhere else but New York, that there were great opportunities, that people were buying things for 10 cents on the dollar, and what was I doing fee-based consulting and workout work. And after several years of plotting and planning, at his encouragement, I created a business plan to start up a real estate investment company on my own with family backing. And I, for lack of a better term, I shopped different cities around the country, not knowing anyone in Atlanta. And Atlanta was just really a fabulous place to come to because in some ways it was like, I don't know, the open Wild West. It was very welcoming. Everyone was an ambassador at that time. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of it in a nutshell. I came here. As a matter of fact, I started in an executive suite on Lenox Road, and I had a room not much different than the room we're sitting in today with no windows. And I sort of hid in the executive suite every day, realizing that people who were calling me were going to get their phone answered by a very professional-sounding receptionist who would screen out the calls. And I, you know, if you will, I guess like most entrepreneurs, you know, faked it till I felt I could make it.
Mm. Wow.
Now, I know you said your family kind of backed you and they've played this non-traditional role in your business. Can you kind of explain how they've been involved?
Sure. I'm not sure I exactly fit into the category of family business, but I guess I'm a tangential aspect of a family business. Kaufman Realty Group is my own business, my own company. But in real estate, it's very typical that every property, every investment is in essence its own company. And what my family took the role of is being my lead investor in the deals that I put together. And so just as if you might go to friends or an institutional investor, when I started out, I went to my family and I pitched my investment deals to my family. Not much different than, again, a third party put together a pitch book, an investment offering memorandum. In some ways, I think it was a lot more difficult than if it was a third party because I was presenting it to a sophisticated investor who happened to be my father. Mm. And, you know, whereas I think I'm sure I'm not much different than most folks out there that they're, you know, most of us in business develop thick skins, but those of us who are very close, it could be a spouse, it could be a parent, sometimes it's just a word or two can just kind of get through that thick skin. And, you know, so that's, you know, a little bit of the story and how I started. And, you know, I'm very thankful and blessed I've had the opportunity to have had my family's backing. And it's gone through an evolution like any other business or perhaps any family.
You know, one thing we talk about on the show when we have multiple generations involved in a business, does that create an interesting dynamic when you guys hang around the holidays? Is business discussed? Or how do you all deal with kind of the cultural ramifications of business and still you're a son?
When I look back to 1994, 5, 6, I'm not sure when, maybe 7, it took me a few years just to get my stride and develop my confidence and to develop boundaries. And I used to hate certain family get-togethers. I used to hate them because where typically for most people, you put on your body armor during the business day, and then the weekends, holidays are time to enjoy each other's company. Well, I still had my body armor, and it wouldn't be that uncommon during Thanksgiving, you know, for my father to ask about what was going on in XYZ deal. Or what's typical in my family, for whatever reason, I've developed a habit of Sunday night is when I would call home. And for Sunday night at 10 o'clock to start talking about some business deal, good or bad. And after several years and actually some consultation with, this is before I got into Vistage, with a consultant or two, and I think about it, who dealt with family business, helped me develop a, if you will, a script to have a confrontation or slash meeting with my father to develop guidelines. And that is, except for, I'm going to call it emergencies, there's always exceptions, we try to do business during business hours. We might talk in general about business, but on a Sunday call, if we need to get to anything specific, I will forward the conversation to, you know, what is your availability tomorrow or the next day? Let's set something time so we can talk on the phone. Whereas it used to be, we used to have our business meetings on my family's, my father's, my parents' vacation house in their loggia out by the pool during the Christmas New Year's break.
Oh, wow.
It's been a lot of years since we've done those.
Well, you kind of described it. I think of our listeners sitting there thinking about, gosh, you know, capital's so hard to come by these days and thinking, you know, family, what a great alternative. But there certainly seems to be a yin and a yang to it.
That's a great term. There's a yin and a yang. There's I think with anything in life, that's good. There's also consequences or a negative side. Certainly the good is that once you prove your trust, there is a level of trust. And I don't mean once you prove your credibility in your area of expertise, I think you're at a level of proof. But I think that the danger that a lot of people get into is they treat their family associates or family investors, in my case, as family. And I made it a point to try to I treated them with respect as family, but I tried to treat them as if they were third-party investors. I didn't distinguish the fact that, you know, my family's money would be, it's money. I had a fiduciary responsibility to watch over and to be a good steward of capital. And so I provided, you know, sufficient reporting, information, communication to allay the concerns and fears and not take it for granted. But there is a downside. I mean, it's just the hardest thing when I think about it was having to share bad news. Because I don't care what business anyone's in. If you've got a running streak where you're doing well for a period of years, sooner or later something's going to happen. And as I mentioned, my industry is very cyclical. And so we've had some bumps on the road. And that, you know, those first calls were difficult. And I remember the advice my father gave me years ago. And again, his background was at Wall Street, where money was just more of it was a tool. And he said, you know, losses are losses. And generally speaking, the best loss is your first loss. Take it, move on, you know, don't fret about it. I think that was easier said than done, but that was the advice that he gave me. And
Larry, he mentioned something about having a conversation in a very direct way. And I know that you are a facilitator of Fierce Conversations, which is a methodology, if you will. Talk a little bit about that. I'm sure, I don't know if that's the coaching that you might have given him for those conversations, but what he described is very typical for our listeners, in that there is always going to have to be, it's so different talking from a third party that you don't know versus a family. How does that Fierce Conversations come into play?
Well, I'm actually going to plug a book, and it's not mine because I haven't written one yet. There is a woman by the name of Susan Scott who was a chair a number of years ago who wrote a book called Fierce Conversations. And it was really a collection and a history and a methodology of what we do as chairs with our members. I still believe that it is one of the most impacting books that anybody dealing with family members, business associates, friends can read, because what it really shows people how to do is not the fact that they have to have a conversation, but how to have the conversation. The book's title, Fierce Conversations, is actually a misnomer, because most people, when they think of the word fierce, they think of a negative connotation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I work with and talk with my members is that fierce is not a negative connotation, but a very positive one, in which we are really having a real conversation. Those of us who have been around long enough and remember the carnivals of years past, and you used to have the cardboard cutouts and you'd stick your head in through Superman or Catwoman, mm-hmm. or whatever the case is, that you created a persona that really wasn't you. And we like to say that a real, true, fierce conversation is when you come out from behind yourself and into the conversation and make it real. Mm. So it's what leaders have to do. It is one of their jobs is to have fierce conversations with anybody and everybody, whether it be family, whether it be investors, whether it be vendors. The only really good conversations are the real conversations. Mm.
And that's when the bad news has to flow. The more real you are, the better it is, typically. Yeah. Craig, you know, you mentioned a cyclical business. That's no surprise to anybody listening. So we had this great beginning of your business and kind of starting out as things were turning around. And you've mentioned Vistage's role in kind of being that steady force. What are the particular challenges around managing such a cyclical business?
Well, one of the challenges is that real estate investment is somewhat of a timing play. And while it may be impossible to time the exact peak or trough of a market, in a market like Atlanta, where there's very little barriers to entry, meaning in the case of office buildings, it seems like every cycle there's more office buildings that are being built, and therefore rents only reach a certain level, there's generally a time you want to be buying, a time you want to be executing your plan, and a general time period you want to try to exit. And only in hindsight do we know that for sure. But we can go back several cycles and see the patterns. So one of the great challenges is scaling your business, because unlike a traditional business of manufacturing widgets, where you may try to grow your widget production by X percent a year, this business is cyclical, and therefore its resources are cyclical. So, you know, one of the things that that I do is I try to keep my staff size down to a minimum and leverage with independent contractors and other type of service providers. And obviously Vistage can come in very handy because even just during those down times, and now I've owned my business through two down cycles, it doesn't really matter how well you plan. And Larry's got a great term. He's, you know, we've talked in many discussions about, and that is you plan for a crisis before the crisis. Once you're in the crisis, once you're in the downturn, you're just kind of moot. You know, you're doing what you've got to be doing. So Vistage has been able to kind of, keep me honest to what I said I was going to do and have me do it. And obviously no one likes doing the ugly things, whether it's downsizing or, cutbacks, but it's all part of survival.
Let me add something to that. And back in February of 2003, Craig's group had an economist that Vistage has been working with for quite a number of years. And he stood in front of that group in February of 2003 and said, whatever you're going to do with your business, and if you're going to sell it, you want to sell it in 2006, 2007, and probably before 2008. Now, this is in 2003 before any of this hit. He himself these days will say he didn't figure it to be as long or as deep as it was. But some of the resources that we have available at Vistage, we're already talking to our members of saying 5 years from now, you better be out of the market if you really want to be, or you better ready to batten down the hatches. Mm-hmm. Of that group, we had three people who sold prior to that time at the top of the market. At the top of the market. And so they were very happy.
Yeah, I bet they were.
And it's interesting as I think back, because I was in that group after the tech bust, 2000-2001, when so many members felt like they were blindsided. And at the time, I recall the discussion prior to that tech bust was top line sales growth. And the next few years, I think there was an awakening to the membership to being more nimble and agile, and it's about creating value. And every business has got all different definition of value. In my case, we were net sellers, meaning we sold a lot more than we bought during 2006 and 2007. And what we also did is starting about 2005, 6 or 7, I don't remember the exact year, my family started divesting and bringing in outside capital, which was very readily available at the time. And I can't say I ever, nor anyone in our group ever predicted, nor that economist that you're referring to, Larry, predicted exactly what was going to happen. And I don't think anyone could imagine how deep a crash it was. But there were a lot of signs that things were too frothy and didn't make sense.
Yeah. Well, what you mentioned with all the building in Atlanta, what other trends in the commercial real estate market would you say are different in Atlanta than perhaps other major metropolitan areas?
Atlanta has been predominantly a growth market. If you think about Atlanta in the 1960s, the MSA had about 1 million or so population. When I came to Atlanta in 1994, I think in round numbers it may have been about 3.5 million, and it seems like about every decade we've been growing at about 1 million people, and we haven't kept up, the pace of infrastructure, as we all know now looking at the newspaper headlines. The challenge it brings with Atlanta is like just a few other markets around the country. We're great places to do business, but these are hard markets. Atlanta's a hard market to create long-term value. It's almost like you have to create the value during the cycle because, as I mentioned, there's always other building, whether it's shopping centers, office buildings in the market I'm in. There's always constantly more product, which means, unlike, a complete opposite example would be New York City, where you have, real barriers to entry. And as demand for office space goes up, rent goes up substantially. Atlanta is a great place for anyone to operate a business. Housing's affordable, and so is office space affordable. But as an investor, it's a trading market. You know, in other words, whereas some markets you can hold for a very, very long time and create value.
So your point, you just have to be really nimble and have capital on hand to be able to take advantage of opportunities when they come up.
Correct. And you have to be, you know, I'd say there's sort of three components. You have to be aware and in the market, be able to buy right, have the capital that's flexible enough, and be nimble enough and hands-on enough to work the process. In this cycle, unlike perhaps the early 1990s, I personally don't think that you're just going to be able to buy office buildings, as an example, hold them for a year or two, and flip them for a tremendous value. I think there may be opportunities, but it's going to take work to increase occupancy, to work the process.
You know, Larry, one of the things Craig mentioned that Vistage has been important for is getting above the fray. And for most of our guests, that's been the issue. They get really bogged down in details. So, you know, when he's been with you for 12 years, I'm guessing that when he first arrived, he wasn't way above the fray as he is now. And I'm sure that's typical of members, new members, as they enter. How do you draw that out? What can you do to get somebody out from under the details?
After Larry's through, I'll tell you what Larry did to me. The exercise Larry gave me, but I want Larry to answer first.
Yeah, perfect.
I think there's a couple of answers to that. One is traditional stuff, having a long-term vision and strategy. A lot of the folks come in with it, but they come in with it as words on a piece of paper or words on the wall, and they really don't operate in that way. The second, which I think is sometimes even more important, is having a really good, well-picked, functional leadership team. Mm-hmm. There's another book out in the marketplace called Growing Pains, and it talks about the direction and how a company grows and the stages they go through and things of that nature. I'll break it into two simplistic ones, and the first is that which is entrepreneurial-driven, where that entrepreneur still has a hand in and maybe even required to be involved in some functional area of the business, whether it be operations, sales, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The group that Craig is a member of is in a member of the second group, and that is that they typically have functional management teams, mm-hmm. leadership teams, where they are not involved in that functional day-to-day aspect. And for a true entrepreneur, whether they be 25 years old or 65 years old, and I've dealt with both, that's a real trap. They get sucked back into the day-to-day. But if they have the right people who will keep them out of it, mm-hmm. And sort of shoo them out the door and say, I've got this and you go do that, that will be helpful. And finally, I'll go one final thing, and that is I tell all my CEOs that what their job is, mm-hmm. and they have four primary responsibilities. And those responsibilities is to set the vision and the direction and the culture of the organization. They have to hold everybody accountable. They have to make sure they establish and maintain the critical relationships for the business, and they have to develop their key people. Everybody else is there. That's where they work on the business. Everybody else is doing the business of the business on a daily basis. So that's sort of a foundation upon which mm-hmm. where I start.
Mm-hmm. And Craig?
How did that work for you?
Well, my memory's foggy. I'm sure there's lots of things I don't remember about our initial meetings and discussions. What I do recall is I was looking for some type of outside resource to help me take my company, which at the time was in the entrepreneurial stage, going through a severe growth spurt, both in the amount of business we were doing, developments we were doing, and thus people we were needing to hire. We didn't have systems in place. We didn't have a senior management or a leadership team per se in place. You know, it was fun, but it was very chaotic. So I recall Larry's first homework assignment that he gave me when I was contemplating about being a Vistage. Actually, then the organization was called Tech, mm-hmm. then a Tech member. And Larry referenced a book by, I believe it was Michael Gerber, the E-myth, the entrepreneurial myth. And Michael Gerber, I believe, was the one that, you know, talked about working on the business, not in the business. But in the book, it was like a shock. And when he went through statistics, which I don't recall specifically, but, you know, about how many businesses go out of business, how many new startups go out of business within the first 2 years, 3 years, due to, in many cases, burnout. And from that, I realized that, you know, business, I guess like life, is it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. And I don't remember exactly when, but it was around that time period. I remember going to play golf with a banker of ours who many years later became a member of our group. And I'm a horrible golfer, but hey, I get invited to play
Join
golf.
The club.
But if I get invited to play golf, if you do, you know, hey, you know, we all can't play like Larry. Well, my associate and I were driving up to the golf course, we were kind of talking about kind of, you know, what do we want to just, you know, how do we want to, you know, what do we want to do? What do we want? What points do we want to get across? We're both terrible golfers. This person was a one handicap at the time. So it wasn't that we were trying to impress them with golf. We were trying to just impress them. We knew what we were doing. And I caught myself rubbing my chest that I don't know if I was having chest pains through, I guess it was just stress because I've never had any heart conditions, and I've been in very good health my whole life, but I caught myself, and this was right around that time, to, you know, business is a marathon, and there is, Larry is very right. You know, if you don't have the right systems and people in place, you're going to burn out.
Mm. So, you know, over these many years of watching the cycles and watching, Craig, from your observation, what have been some of the tipping points along the way that you've seen third party, because that's your... that's kind of the perspective that you've had.
Larry's pondering.
Yeah.
You know, I look at growth, whether it be financial growth, growth of an individual. Most people tend to look at growth curves and think that they have this nice curve and it goes up all the time. What I have observed in most cases is that growth is a stair step, that all of a sudden someone, and this would include Craig and any of the other people with whom I've worked over the years, that, you know, they're sort of collecting data, they're sort of doing things and et cetera, et cetera. And then there is some point, and it's different for everybody, but there's some point at which all of a sudden they hit this wall and they have to climb this wall. And that wall is almost straight up, and it's and once they do that, though, it's like this significant breakthrough. Some people like to call them flathead moments, type of thing. They slap their forehead, and it's like, oh wow, you know, well, that same thing has been there for 6 months, 6 years, et cetera, and all of a sudden there is this vision, like, oh, it could be different, and if I do it this way, and they do. Mm-hmm. And so there's not any particular, whether it be Craig or anybody else, that I would say, okay, on January the 3rd of 2005, such and such happened. Mm-hmm. But on an overall basis, I watch these CEOs and these leaders that they struggle with certain things, and then they'll have a breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And then they'll go on for a while in the struggle, and then they'll have another breakthrough. Mm-hmm. And Craig, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I have something comes to mind, and I'll try to change the names to protect the innocent. But most of us can see things in other people sometimes so clearly that we're completely blind to in ourselves. And the Vistage Group, I don't know if our group is typical of other groups, but in the beginning, we were all too nice to each other because, you know, that's how we're trained as people. We're supposed to be nice to each other in business. And then after, I don't know if it was a few years or how long it was, you get to the stage where we realize we're paying a lot of money for this. We're committing a whole day a month. And that's a lot of money in itself, just the time. You know, we don't have patience. So if we see something, we're going to say it. And so I have been known to sometimes stew on problems and sometimes fret on them. And I plot until I'm comfortable. And several years ago, Someone referred to me by the name of someone else. Let's just say it's Joe Smith. I hope there's no Joe Smiths in the audience, but that, you know, hypothetical name. And someone told me that, Craig, you are doing a Joe Smith. That was the name of someone who was no longer in our group. I don't know if he left our group or if he was kicked out of our group. I don't remember, because he couldn't move on. He couldn't move on. And after that day, I decided I will never want to be called a Joe Smith again, and I will do everything I can not to be. That was a tipping point for me.
Interesting.
And Larry, you know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Interesting. You know, Larry, you mentioned something when you described Vistage, that it's non-competing businesses. So, Craig, from your perspective, so these are not people who are sitting around this table that understand real estate, because they're obviously not in that business, and vice versa. When you're advising them or listening to their issues, has that brought new perspective? Is that a plus for you in terms of getting diverse input?
Absolutely. And it can be a challenge at times, because every industry has its own lingo and own speak, and sometimes we take comfort in that. So you've got to learn to communicate and strip away that. However, almost every industry and every business involves dealing with people and involves, to some degree, dealing with some type of capital, whether you're borrowing money from a bank, it's your own money, you've got family, you've got third-party investors. So there are some common things that you have to deal with. And I'm going to say the other thing, which has been extremely beneficial to me and probably beneficial to a number of our group members, is in my case, being in the commercial real estate business. So I spend much of my time on the finance investment side. But then there's, you know, the reality is, who pays my paycheck? Ultimately, it's the tenants that pay their rent, who pay, you know, the operating expenses of the building get paid, investor distributions get made, and so on and so forth. It helps put me in touch with what businesses out there are thinking. And the office building business is about housing businesses. So it puts me indirectly closer to just, you know, customers.
Interesting. Interesting.
Now, Larry, I know you talked about Vistage having speakers come in. You talked about this economist. Can you talk a little bit more about, I mean, what kind of speakers usually does Vistage bring in, and what's the intent in terms of benefiting its members?
Vistage probably has one of the largest databases of speakers around. The last count that I heard was somewhere between 1,700 and 1,800 speakers that we can or will use in a given year across the United States and across the world, because we are international. Actually, when I'm talking to a prospective member who's interested in joining a group, I will make the comment, I said, think of any topic that you can think of, and I'll probably have 3 to 4 speakers that I can put in front of you within a week on that particular topic. So it could be anywhere from business to personal. Business side, it could be strategy. It could be on dealing with personnel problems, motivation, hiring, firing. On the personal side, it could be health. It could be family issues. It could be, you know, we're reaching this age where we're all having to take care of our parents. All the economic issues. It could be financial planning. It go on and on. One of the things that I do recognize, though, with regard to our speakers, and they recognize it also, is that a group of owners, CEOs, presidents have very limited time and very limited bandwidth when it comes to attention span.
I'll second that.
Yeah. Can anybody say ADD? But anyway, the reality is, and it's been a hallmark of our speakers for many years, is that anybody who comes in and wants to talk about a lot of theory typically doesn't last very long. The members, the people, these leaders are looking for, what can I learn today? What can I use when I leave this room? And all of our speakers, agree that this is not a selling environment. Now, the reality is that some of the members come running up afterwards and they want to talk to this particular person. That's all well and good. But there are actions that these ladies and gentlemen can take away from our speakers immediately and put to work. And part of my job is, after we've had them in there, in my follow-ups and sessions with the members, is to follow up on that. What are you going to do? What did you learn out of this particular speaker? Things of that nature.
It sounds like a whole lot of accountability. That's kind of a theme. Craig, am I right? I mean, I kind of heard it from your family, the accountability. These are outside investors who you have to have Sunday dinner with and spend Thanksgiving with, and it almost raises the bar on accountability, and the same thing through Vistage. Has that been kind of a common theme? And more importantly, do you think that's had a positive impact on the business?
It's accountability in a different way than most people think of accountability. Oftentimes people think of accountability as, I need to make this phone call, I need to finish this project, I need to, and therefore, you know, kind of going back to how we were brought up with, you know, school and tests, you know, I need someone to make sure I do it. You're really not going to have that here. The accountability that you're going to have is people pushing you to determine what is your direction. Because we all know, for right or for wrong, I mean, we all know our business is better than anyone else in that group does. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean we know everything that we should. But, you know, we are the expert of our business. But there will be people challenging us to our assumptions. There'll be people challenging us if we said 1 month after making a presentation, this is the path that we are going to take. You know, I've got to hire some people. I've got to downsize. I've got to make a difficult decision. You know, the next month, generally speaking, there's going to be some follow-up. Okay, what did you do? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there may be a reason why we ebbed and flowed, but you can usually tell when people get defensive, it's because they're just trying to duck an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different type of accountability, and it's really only meant, I think, for people who are self-starters, highly motivated, and are open to challenge and being challenged.
Yeah, I will go back to the story that Craig talked about before about Joe Smith, and that's a good example of the accountability. Because Joe Smith essentially would come in every couple of months with an issue, wouldn't do anything about anything ultimately. Each issue, if you really looked at the thread, was related to the first one he ever brought in. And finally, the group looked at him, and I looked at him and said, if you're not willing to make the changes you need to be, then that's okay, that's your decision, but you don't belong here.
And to expand upon that, I mean, it's funny, this is probably 7-8 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I even remember what the core of the issues were. We had a speaker probably 10 years ago who spoke on a topic called four-year-old behavior. And my kids aren't yet 4 years old. I've got twin boys that are 3, but I can sort of picture what the four-year-old behavior is. And basically, he talked about employees not taking, being responsible, taking ownership. And also explained and demonstrated it starts at the top. So Joe Smith, our hypothetical person, kept coming in every few months with different examples of four-year-old behavior. The exact story was different. The people were different. The problem was the same. And he never addressed the problem. And that was really looking at himself.
Did he not see that trend, even though you all were blatantly pointing it out to him?
Larry, you might be able to answer that better than I, because
he saw it. And the reality is, most people who have an issue like that see it. They just, for whatever reason, can't deal with it.
Mm.
Yeah. And by the way, just to add a little bit to that 4-year-old behavior, and it basically is to defer, you know, deny and defer. Think about what a 4-year-old did. You know, who put that bike there? Oh, it wasn't me, it was Harry. You know, so you'll find that your employees deny and defer also quite a bit.
Well, what I'm hearing is that, you know, we started this discussion out with saying trusted advisors are important, but I'm also hearing from both you, Craig, and from you, Larry, that the part of that is you need to be ready. You need to be ready for that trusted advisor group. You need to be ready to take in the tough conversations, to have the tough conversations, and to process and do something with the information. And if you really don't want that then no sense getting involved and spending the money or getting other people's time involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think you do not only yourself, but you do the other people in the group incredible disservice if you're not willing to open up to both to open up your business, open up to be vulnerable, to open for advice, and sometimes it sounds like criticism. Larry used to use the word, I haven't heard in a while, called carefrontation. And sometimes it's just confrontation, but, you know, the idea is to be caring, but it doesn't always come across that way. but it generally is. I mean, we want the best for our fellow members. And the other thing is, you know, we want people who take a vested interest, take an interest in other people's businesses and their lives, because we can all learn from each other. Joe Smith wasn't the only person I've seen in my 12 years who's phased out sometime, but most of them phase out a lot earlier.
Yeah.
He was there for several years.
That's impressive to last that long, be getting the same advice and still do nothing.
He didn't last quite that long. He was in for maybe a year at the most.
Maybe it just felt like a few years.
It went on forever and ever.
You know, talk about sharing advice. This is a point in our show where we like to kind of summarize with some tips that are takeaways that hopefully our audience will write down and hopefully they will actually employ. And we are building an entire repertoire of these on our site. So, Larry, I'd love to start with you, kind of summarizing all of our discussion today. What three tips would you like to leave our audience with?
Well, I'd given that some thought before I came in, and I didn't know whether they would be, these particular ones would be addressed as we went through, and they were not. But I think they're really critically important. So here's the three I'm going to give you. The first is, and it's true of any organization, but it is absolutely critical within a family based business, and that is the values being clearly defined. When we think about family businesses and ones that have gone wrong and are not working well, it's marred by conflict, and conflict ultimately comes down to values, what it is that these group of people believe as an entity, and those families and expanding that into any business that are very clear about who they are and where they're going is very important. So that would be my number one. Those have to be spent some time doing. Number two is what a turn of phrase that I call there's family-owned businesses, and then there are businesses owned by the family. They are significantly different. The family-owned businesses tend to think of that as being family-owned. You can get into those personality issues, things of that nature, versus that the business owned by a family, they are a group of stockholders that just happen to be related to each other. So, again, there's a perception and the viewpoint from whence they come. And the final one has to do with family members within the business themselves. Family members, ultimately, when you look at a legal business, are employees. And many, there's a difference between ownership and the responsibility as an employee. When that line is blurred or crossed, typically we find problems. And so getting a family to recognize that, yes, they might be an owner, but that doesn't give them the right within their functional responsibilities as an employee, that can get real, real interesting. So that, you know, when I think of the family businesses with whom I've dealt, you know, mm-hmm. I can almost tell you that one or more of those have been violated.
Yeah. Excellent.
Interesting.
Excellent. Craig, and from your perspective, some tips that you'd like to leave our audience with.
Sure. I think we discussed these, but I'll summarize the three of them. If you are responsible for someone else's money, if you are, in my case, I'm an operating partner in a real estate investment company, then my job first and foremost is to do the worrying for my investors, whether they're family or non-family, so that they don't have to worry. So my job is to be a fiduciary and be a good steward of capital. And to do that, you need to have effective communication reporting. So whether it's family or non-family, treat it like non-family. Treat it like a business. That's number one. Number two is establish boundaries. And again, this goes to the question of, you know, is Thanksgiving dinner the right time to talk about a business dealing? Probably not. So separate the family from the business and, you know, keep them both healthy. The third thing is, you know, going back to really why we're here, and I'll put a plug in for Larry and Vistage. I think just being part of it for 12 years says I must get something out of it, or maybe I'm just a little slow. But have advisors. I use Vistage for this, not just Larry, but my whole group. Have outsiders who can help you confront reality, because as an owner of a business, oftentimes you'll find your associates won't always tell you what you should know. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. Sometimes they'll just tell you what they want you to hear, and sometimes you just hear what you want to hear. And I think in a family business, it's even more complex. So have outsiders who will help you, you know, challenge you to see the light.
That's great. And we're really happy to have you guys come on today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great. And it's, our listeners sometimes would like to know how to reach out to you. Craig, how would they contact you?
You can check out my website, Kaufman Realty Group. The website is www.kaufmaninc.com. That's www.kaufmaninc.com.
Great. And telephone?
404-816-0036.
Thank you. And Larry, how can they reach you?
Well, my website's a little long and convoluted, so we'll just go with a phone number. I can be reached always on my cell at 404-405-0759.
And you mentioned two books during your discussion. Can you recap those? It was
Fierce Conversations by Susan Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one was a book called Growing Pains. However, I will also warn the people out there that it reads like a college master's manual, but the information contained within is absolutely excellent.
Great. And we'll have you back on when you've finished your book, and
you can
be talking about that. And for those of you who want to refer back, a couple of tips for you. You can always find a recording of each of our shows on our website, which is www.familybusinessradio.businessradiox.com. And if you go to that site even today, you will find full contact information and links to Vistage and links to Craig's site. And on Tuesday of next week, you will find the entire podcast that can be downloaded, and it will be remaining on our site for forever. It'll be an archive. So always a reference for you. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Very much.